Vitrolabs makes leather, which they say is indistinguishable from the real thing. Now, in an industry which produces 23 billion square feet, which is roughly 823 square miles of leather each year, imagine the animal cost. Vitrolabs offers a legitimate solution, it seems. I speak to the CTO of the company, Lance Kaiser, about scaling up, commercialization, and the future of leather. I'm Alex Crisp, and welcome to another episode of Future of Foods Interviews. Now you can join the cool kids and followers on Substack. Okay, so thank you, Lance Kaiser from Vitrolabs, for joining me on Future of Foods Interviews. Now, what you do there at Vitrolabs isn't food, but we are making an exception because you're using a lot of the same technology that is used in sort of cultivating meat and milk and kind of various other things. But what you do there is you cultivate materials such as leather, which is very exciting. So can you explain a little bit about what you do? And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, definitely. So as you say, we are focused on materials. Our product is really skin. We grow using cell culture skin in a lab. So the way the process works, we start with skin cells from a cow, from a live cow. At some point in the past, you take a small biopsy from that cow. And that's just using a small needle to take a sample of cells from the skin. And then those cells are grown in the lab, and we isolate the cell type that we're really interested in, which is called a dermal fibroblast. These are the type of cells that grow in our skin or in cow skin, and they make primarily collagen. They make the proteins that form our skin. So that's what we're after, is these cell types that make a lot of collagen. Once we get this cell type isolated, we go through a process that your listeners are probably pretty familiar with, of immortalizing those cell lines. These are just taking genetic elements that are commonly used in the industry to basically make it so those cells can divide infinitely. So this gives us an infinite supply of cow skin cells, which is really our starting point. There's two other raw materials that are really important in our process. The first one I'll talk about is called a scaffold. These type of skin cells, they like to attach to something and grow. And so we have to give them a surface in our manufacturing process for them to attach and grow, and so that they can make these skin proteins. We have developed a scaffold in-house that's sort of a key feature of our product. We can adjust the properties of the leather by adjusting the properties of the scaffold. So we have a whole bunch of different types of scaffold types we've developed. But essentially, the idea is the cells attach to this scaffold, and then we feed them nutrients in the form of media, which is a liquid nutrient mix that we feed to the cells, and then they grow and divide on the scaffold. Initially, once we seed them on there, they're just sort of attached to the scaffold, but they start to divide and grow, and they basically cover the entire scaffold with cells, and then they start to excrete proteins, skin proteins. Primarily collagen is the one we're concerned about. But they excrete these proteins onto the scaffold. And at the end of our process, which is about 28 days, they fully encase that scaffold with skin proteins, this collagen material. And that's what we harvest from the process. And then we designed this so it works with the existing leather tanneries out in the world. There's a whole ecosystem, obviously, of tanneries. And so we wanted this product to work in any process. We don't want it to be bespoke to a certain tannery process. So once we harvest the hides, we put it in salt water to preserve it, and then it can go to any tannery and go through any process that they might use. Some use vegetable tanning, some use chromium tanning. We're agnostic to that. We've designed the product to work in any type of tanning process.
Mm. So how like traditional leather is this material?
That's what we're really excited about, is that it's very similar to leather. So because we're using the cow skin cells and we're giving them the signals and the nutrients to make the collagen that is in cow skin, we are making actual leather on the scaffold. So in terms of dealing with customers, they have their technical specs. So we'll go to a company, either in the luxury industry or in the car industry, and they all have technical specifications around the leather. And that's usually like tear resistance and strength and things like that. And we perform amazingly well in that, partly because we are growing the actual collagen that's in cowhide. And we can also engineer other properties into our product using the scaffold by choosing the type of scaffold that we use, whether we want it to be thicker or thinner, whether we want it to be plant-based scaffold or one that's really strong. In terms of like feel, we feel like leather. A lot of the way leather feels and smells and behaves comes from that tanning and finishing process. A cowhide or our hides are really sort of like a blank canvas for the tanner. And so they can like use different polymers, they can use different filling agents, they can use different chemistry in that process to create whatever type of leather they want for their particular, whether it's a handbag or a car. And again, it's sort of the strength of our process is that we're providing the raw material to them, and then they can do whatever they need to do to make it into the type of leather for their particular product.
I mean that's I mean it sounds almost too good to be true, really. So how and so what are some of the challenges that you have faced up to now and are dealing with? How are you dealing with them?
Lots of challenges. So it does sound good, but as with any technology, and I've been developing technologies for a while, there's a Haitian state or a saying I just heard this week on a podcast where it's like behind every mountain are more mountains. And that's essentially what research is like and development is like. As soon as you solve one problem, there's more problems to solve. So we've run into many. I'll tell you, like, the main story I like to tell around this is often like once you develop a product or something, and then you're telling somebody about it, there's a very nice linear path. If we had an idea, we went in the lab, then we went to a factory, and we were successful. In reality, it's often far messier than that. And In Vitro Labs has gone through that messy phase as well. The company's been around for 7 years, and they were trying to do something that had never been done before at an industrial scale. And when you start with that blank canvas, there's a lot of just like figuring it out. And so the team spent many years figuring out like how to make the scaffolds and what scaffold types work, what skin cells work, what type of media work, and what type of signals need to be in that media. When I got there about 2 years ago, a lot of this had been initially worked out. They had a pilot plant running, and the idea was to start scaling up while driving costs down. Cost is always going to be an issue in this type of process, and that was going to be our big focus. But after being there for about 2 or 3 months, a scientist came into my office and said, "Our product is not going to work, and we can't scale it up the way we're making it right now." And so obviously this is terrifying news to hear, 5 or 6 years into the process. But it turns out he was right, and it turns out that that was the biggest gift we could have been given because we had to stop. We had to step back and say, what's not working here? Why is it not working? And if we were to redesign this process and this approach and our research program, what would we do? And so that very scary moment, forcing us to reevaluate what we were doing, actually put us onto this path of having a scalable product now. We stepped back and looked. Our measurement systems were bad. This is often an underemphasized part of technology development, but measurements are your eyes and your ears and your senses when you're an engineer or a scientist, and our measurements were not working well, and they were leading us in the wrong direction. Second, our approach to growing the tissue at the time was just not scalable. It worked at a lab scale and maybe slightly larger than a lab scale, but it wasn't going to be something that we could scale to the size that we need to scale to have an impact on the leather industry. And thirdly, we just didn't understand the tissue growth process well enough. It was a little bit of a black box for us. We knew the signals we were giving the cells. We knew what their general time course was, but we really didn't understand the interactions of these raw materials, how the cells interacted with the scaffold, and how those both interacted with the media components we were giving them. So we completely redesigned the research program to focus on getting better measurement systems put together. We started looking around for if we were going to completely reset our manufacturing process. What bioreactors would we use? And the team found an amazing bioreactor system that was already commercialized, already used in industry. Nobody had thought to use it for tissue growth. And so we tried it and it worked great. So now we have a very scalable bioreactor system that we can scale up on. And finally, the understanding the tissue process required us to look at how we were doing work in the lab. Like I said, our process takes 4 weeks. It's very slow. And so that means our iteration cycle was very slow. And so we had all these questions around like how the process was working, but it took weeks and weeks to run a single experiment, sometimes months to run a single experiment. So we completely changed how we did that work. We developed a high throughput system where we can grow very small samples of cells, but grow them, lots of them so that we can get statistical confidence in what we're doing. Biology is a very noisy process. Cells always perform slightly differently. So it's really a game of repeat testing and repeat measurement. So you need statistics to really be certain about where you're going when you're doing an experiment or when you're scaling something up. And by developing this high throughput process where we could run hundreds of samples and hundreds of samples and run multiple experiments in a month, we really speeded up our ability to sort of query the process and understand how it was working. So that was about 18 months ago. And it really put us on this path where we're at now, where we have a bioreactor system that's scalable. We have a process that's scalable. We have a much better grounding in what our costs are. And we really sort of understand the interactions that are happening in the raw material. So while it was a scary moment at the time, it wound up being the best gift we could have gotten.
So now you're in a situation where you can scale up at a quicker rate and at a sort of cost-effective rate, and you have all the technology and all the hardware in place. Is that right? Is it all kind of ready to go now?
Ready is a hard thing to judge. It's what we have is we have the bioreactor system that works, and there are multiple versions of this bioreactor system to get larger and larger. So we do have a path of scalability there. We've gone through an engineering design cycle where we really analyzed our cost of production to really convince ourselves that once we get to scale, we can compete there and actually, address the markets we need to address because price will always be important to those customers. Now we're on that path of like actually implementing it. I've scaled up five processes in my life, and they're always very nonlinear and messy as you start to step into that manufacturing phase. You really need to understand your cost structure and you really need to understand how your process works. But as you start to step into your first factory and your first production facility and then multiple ones after that, that becomes a challenge in of itself. It's a different challenge. It's not the, getting the technology to even work. We've solved that. Now it's a challenge of how do you scale and how do you do it in a cost-effective way that doesn't destroy the company? You don't want to be making product where you're losing money on it. So you have to be able to address that cost issue. You also have to develop customers at the same time so that there's somebody there to buy that product as you're making it. You have to find these manufacturing facilities to work with. So it becomes more of an execution challenge on the scale-up side versus a pure like technology challenge of like, can we even get it to work? And I'd say that's where we're at right now is in that execution phase where the big challenge comes. Can we execute on this plan to get to scale?
Yeah, well, I suspect you there's going to be no shortage of clients, of customers for this product, and you've already produced the product because you've said that you've used sort of tanneries and that you've spoken to sort of fashion brands and things like that. So you have customers, I understand. So, what have they said about the product? What is their view on the product?
They're excited for it. Like you said, we do see a lot of demand out there. My chief commercial officer is out there every day talking to customers and building out this cohort of customers for us. They're motivated by different reasons, depending on the geographies and where they're at and sort of the tier of leather industry. But particularly in Europe, where we're focused on, they have The CBAM coming out, which is, the carbon border adjustment mechanism. So there's a regulatory network that's forming that will basically charge for carbon efficiency. If you're selling a product that's very carbon inefficient, then eventually you'll be taxed on that. And so some customers are of the opinion of we'll deal with that when it happens. Other ones are very forward-looking in terms of like trying to fix their supply chain now so that they're ready for these type of like taxes that'll be coming down the road. Same thing for the EU Deforestation Act. Leather specifically mentioned in that, as you need to know exactly what plot of land your cow was raised on, essentially, that the leather that's hide was harvested from. And so that also adds cost to the process. So a lot of these customers are motivated by this incoming regulatory framework that's going to start to put pressure on their bottom lines. So they're excited about it for that reason. We offer an alternative to that. We're not the only alternative out there, but we're one of many. But the thing that makes us special, even though we're using a more difficult process for manufacturing versus some of our competitors out there, is that we're growing the actual proteins that they're used to working with. The actual collagen types that the entire leather industry uses already is what's incorporated into our products. So it fits very well within their processes and what they do. So they're excited about it for that. And I think the third thing that we're finding is some customers have very specific performance requirements, and that really comes down to being high strength, low weight. So thin leather that's very strong. And we play very well in that field, particularly versus some of the alternative leathers that are out there. We can grow very thin sheets on these scaffolds, and they can be very strong, as strong as full grain leather, but in a very thin sheet. And so we see that as a niche, a fairly large niche, but a niche that we can play in with some of these customers that are having trouble finding an alternative leather that works in this thin application, but where we work really well in it.
So you're looking at the quality of the product itself, and you were mentioning sustainability, and the environmental impact. Now, clearly, this would have quite a significant environmental impact when you're not, you don't have the livestock. And using up resources and using up space and that sort of thing. I mean, how much regarding sort of animal welfare, and sustainability are you considering when you are developing the product? How much does it come into it?
It's a really important part. Most people in startups are motivated by mission, and a lot of the team at Vitro Labs is the same way. They're motivated by this mission of sustainability and reducing animal cruelty. So it's important in our process of our development process to think about that. And frankly, it's important from a cost perspective as well. Some of the components used in cell culture, like serums and other things that come from an animal source, are ethically fraught because of how they're harvested, but also are incredibly expensive, too expensive for the type of manufacturing process that we're doing. We're competing against a commodity material. And while sustainability is important to us and it's important to our customers, price is really what matters. If we want to really impact the world, we have to compete on price. And to compete on price, we can't use those animal components that are commonly used in cell culture. So as we focus on scalability, we focused on removing serum from our media, removing animal components. There are still some proteins in there that come from an animal source, but the goal is over time to completely remove those from that, both from a mission standpoint as well as from being able to compete on cost with what we have to compete.
So are you going to be selling it as vegan leather?
I don't think we technically qualify for that. There's been a bit of a debate about that, but I mean, they are animal cells used in this. So they're harvested at one point from a cow, but then we've immortalized them. We're not harming animals in the process, but they are animal cells that are involved in it. And so from a positioning for our customers, we don't really rely a lot on this idea of vegan or anything like that. It's mostly from a sort of harm reduction perspective. Leather is damaging to the environment, both how it's manufactured as well as the source material. We want to replace that damaging product with one that's much more sustainable. We leave it to our customers to figure out what they best want to market it as in their individual brands. But what we're offering them is a sustainable product that will help their bottom line due to some of this like tax structure we were talking about, and helps them improve their sustainability goals. And we want to compete with leather on price and performance and not really rely on that like green halo to get them to buy our product.
Interesting. So you talked earlier about your competitors. Do you mean people in the sort of traditional sort of le of sort of livestock leather producing competitors, or are there people doing the same thing as you out there?
There are people doing similar things to us. There's a couple of companies in the world that are also trying to sell culture approach. There are some really well-known companies that are frankly further along in scale for making alternative leathers, either from like mycelium or other approaches like that. So, they are options. The leather industry is huge. It is a truly massive, massive industry. And so it will always exist. There will always be multiple players, probably in the course of my lifetime. Leather will still be out there when we're on the market. These alternatives will still be out there. And so for us, that's why we really focus on, traditional, more business competitive metrics of like performance, price, things like that. We think there's room for all of us out there. And I hope all the alternative leathers are successful because, again, from the mission, we would like to create materials that don't rely on animal cruelty or are damaging to the environment. So I hope they're all successful. And I think there's a big enough market out there that we can all be successful out there.
Sure. So in the next over the next 5 or 10 years, how do you foresee Vitro Labs' place in that market?
Yeah, we are focused on getting to production now. Typically when I've scaled up process in the past, it's a multi-step process. You develop a customer and you move into some sort of contract manufacturing phase. And then as you continue to grow your customers, you move into building a factory. We're focused on doing both of those things. Factories are often a long-term goal and will require significant financing. It's an expensive thing to do. So in the near term, we're trying to get into market with a handful of customers at, what would be huge scale for us, but is a small drop in the bucket when it comes to leather. But really get into, developing those customers, producing product to a contract manufacturer where you don't have to spend all the money to, buy the equipment and build the factory and things like that, and grow the business that way while doing the long-term work that we need to do to get the engineering design done, get the project financing, that like financing from a bank instead of equity financing that you would need to build a factory. So that's, if I'm completely successful in 5 years or 10 years, we will have at least one factory out there making at least, 10 million square feet per year, hopefully building a second one, and have developed, a handful of really solid customers that are buying that product.
So do you predict then that commercially you will be selling your products what in the next 3 years, 5 years? What would you say?
Yeah, I think I in again in the ideal case, which never happens, but what we will push for is over the next 12 to eight, say 12 to 24 months of building this process out in a contract manufacturer and supplying a customer, let's say on the order of, a few hundred thousand square feet, not the millions of square feet that a factory would do. So that's really like our mission number one is to develop that customer or a group of customers and get that contract manufacturing up and running.
I suspect there's one advantage that I imagine you have over food manufacturers in that you don't need to get regulatory approval to sell
That's right.
this
Yeah.
product.
Yeah, we have two big advantages, I would say, over food. One is that regulatory structure is not there. We're not People aren't eating this. They're not taking it as a medicine or a drug or anything like that. So there's not a lot of like oversight or safety concerns around things. And then two, cost. Making protein to eat is a really low bar you got to hit on cost so that people can afford it essentially and then start to incorporate it into their diet. For us, we're essentially taking proteins and putting them in what's essentially a thin layer over a large surface area. So we don't have quite the cost challenges that like a food manufacturer has. And then two, we don't have the regulatory oversight that they have.
I imagine that three that there's not that yuck factor that
Yes. Yeah.
with the consumer, would
Yeah.
you say so?
Yeah, 100% agree with that. That makes things very easy because we're nothing but really upside to a consumer. You know, what they want from leather or what they want from us is what they want from leather. They want that feel, they want that smell, they want that luxury performance that they expect from their handbag or from their phone case. And if it's more sustainable, then that's just a bonus to them, you know, but they don't have to eat it. They don't have to worry about like what's inside of it. And so
Yeah.
there is not a yuck factor.
Well, there's I mean, it's a very interesting area, isn't it? Because food wise, people, you know, the public are probably slower to consider what they're doing as being harmful to animals. Whereas in as regards to fur manufacture and sort of
Yeah.
leather manufacture, it's been a long time coming. I mean, I saw an article last week about the kind of beef eaters, you know, the kind of queens,
Yeah.
you know, their soldiers' hats, and how they're being encouraged to find a less cruel way of producing the same material. So there's an appetite for it out there, isn't there?
Exactly. And I think fur is a good example. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, fur was seen as this sort of mark of luxury. It was like something to aspire to. And then I remember there was a ton of societal pushback on that. And, you know, fur still exists, but it's not as like you don't see it as much as you saw it like when I was a kid. And I feel like leather is poised for that. There's a desire to have alternatives out there. And I think as these companies, including us, rise up and start to meet the expectations in terms of just the performance of the material, it'll be easy to get the consumers to adopt because suddenly it's like there is an alternative. You don't have to rely on this bloody, cruel process to develop this product that people sort of ignore right now when they think about
Yeah.
leather. But as soon as there's an alternative out there, then they'll be like, great, I take that.
But I can see that your approach isn't to necessarily highlight that part of it, because you know it's you probably don't want to go to the market kind of you know sort of saying stop being cruel to animals
Yeah.
and so use our product instead, because that might not work.
Yeah.
Is that about right? I mean, is that like a
Yeah.
big
Yeah.
thing, or I mean, is that a decision that you have made?
Yeah. It's definitely a conscious approach, and I think for a number of reasons. I previous startups I helped found one was in the alternative dairy space, and then before that was in, a company that was engineering yeast cells to make all sorts of like chemical products in a more sustainable way. And it's really hard to get anybody to adopt a product based on strictly sustainability. It's people like that idea and they like the fact that there's less animal cruelty or it's better for the planet. But consumers and businesses both make decisions on financial reasons and performance reasons. In the food world, it's taste and price. And for us, it'll be hand feel and price. But it's hard to get people to buy something just on an idea of better sustainability. So for us to achieve our mission, which is to, you know, ultimately provide an alternative to leather that's not cruel and is better for the planet, we know that we have to hit those price targets. We have to make it cheap enough that brands can adopt it.
Yeah.
And so that's what we focus on, really. That's how we see the best way to have impact.
I suppose also when you are launching a new product, you don't want to sort of ruffle too many feathers, kind of upsetting farmers and that sort of thing, which is clearly what's going to be the problem for kind of cultivated meat and things like that in the media.
Yep. And our brands all depend on leather right now. The ones we'll be working with, they have, huge established businesses around leather. So you don't want to start off by saying, all your business is bad, start buying our product, because, it'll take a while for us to scale to that scale anyway. So we see ourselves more as an alternative, an option for these companies as they want to improve their bottom line, as some of these taxes come into play. We're there to support them. We have an option for them that has performance and hopefully the same price, and they can just adopt us as they transition over.
I suppose the other option, I suppose, kind of with fashion brands and with high-end labels, they could be a premium on this product, right? Because it's quite unique and it's quite sought after, and I'd imagine that could be an area.
Yeah, definitely. And we offer advantages even over cow leather in certain areas for price as well. Like, one thing I learned coming into this business is that 50% of the hide is just thrown away. Especially at higher end fashion houses where they're looking for the most premium leather, because there's scarring on it and other things, imperfections in the hide. And so even though, they buy the whole cow skin, they're throwing away half of it. We offer alternatives. We're a better alternative there too, because you can use 100% of what we're using. You don't have to worry about the scarring and things like that on the cow hides. And so it gives their designers better options as well.
So I just wanted to talk quickly about some money and that sort of thing. So I mean I know this industry has been quite tough, a tough one to raise money over the last 2 years or so. Have you had any problems with that?
It's definitely a struggle. We're in the process of closing out a round of financing, and it's taken a long time to get there. It's definitely, the venture capital space in general has shrunk quite a bit. We're no longer in that low interest money era where, money was just flooding into startups. And biology in particular, particularly cellular biology, has taken a hit. Or just there was a huge influx of cash into it over the last 4 or 5 years, and then there's not a lot of investment in there right now. We're a little bit different. We're not making food. We, like I said, we have a better line of sight to hitting the cost targets that we need to hit in order to be a competitive business out there. And we found some really good investors, but it has been a very hard road for us. It's a very tough time right now.
Yeah, I spoke to one of your investors at Agronomics, Anthony. So I suppose you came into Vitro Labs at the end of the at the end of what some people might call the bubble, at the more at the more realistic time in the industry. Did you, I mean, were you aware that's what was happening when you arrived?
I suspected it. These things tend to follow that cycle. I started my career in synthetic biology, which also had a sort of hype cycle, and then the trough of disillusionment, as they call it. So I suspected that was happening. What really attracted me was there was the technology there, but it was that, what we talked about, the challenge for price is not as hard for this product. It seemed like a product that was perfectly suited for a biological approach to solve it. So I thought that, yes, there was going to be potentially this wave of challenges throughout the cellular biology world. A friend of mine wrote a techno-economic analysis paper really analyzing the production cost of cellular biology, and that was pretty, negative on the prospects of it. So I'd seen his report on what pricing might look like for them. But I was excited, one, because it was a material, two, it wasn't a food, and we didn't have those cost structures. So I thought there was something here that, even with the challenges that might be coming to the industry, this was different enough that, I thought there was a chance for it to actually get to scale. And so that's what excited me.
I mean, it's certainly a very interesting area, and it fixes I mean, it's a solution, isn't it? Kind of vegetarians often sort of suffer from that accusation from people who sort of say, okay, so you don't eat meat, but you wear leather shoes and you know, how do you justify that? And you're creating a scenario where they can say, well, actually, these shoes
Exactly.
are cultivated cells.
Exactly.
So it's a whole new era, and I suspect it's going to be. I mean, do you see people wearing shoes made from your products over in the next 5 years, would you say?
I definitely hope so.
I mean, which are the
Definitely in the
brands
back.
you're working with? Have you got some major brands that you're kind of
We
selling your?
do. We have some major brands in the shoe industry that we're working with. For shoes, the challenge is even bigger. The scale is even bigger. And so, that's one of the things I think is going to be a challenge for Vidro Labs. After we get those first few customers on there's going to be big demand, and we're going to have to scale very quickly to meet that demand because, even one of our customers, just one in the luxury space, uses like 30 million square meters per year of leather, which is just a mind-boggling amount right now when I think about what we make in a year. So, shoes are a very exciting area for us. It's a very big market for us. And again, what we see with some of these consumer or customers is that some of them are like, we will deal with that in the future. And other ones are very much focused on how do we get our supply chain right now so that in the future we can avoid some of the taxes and some of the other challenges that when as these regulations start to kick off. And so it's those ones that have that forward-looking approach that are really trying to find some supply chain solutions right now that we're working with. And it's exciting. But it's also one of those things where it's, slightly scary too when you look at the volume of material they could potentially use from us. It boggles the mind sometimes.
Well, it just goes to highlight how many, how many lives of cattle are used in the making of shoes. And I suppose it must feel quite heartening in a way that you might be part of a new industry that sort of saves the lives of millions of creatures.
A 100%. It's one of those things that, there's almost a cognitive dissonance in people's brains. Some people are really plugged into the issue, but other ones just don't think about it because there's either not alternatives out there, or they've not thought about like what the implications of shoes are or something like that. But I do think that it is exciting for me and is exciting for the team to think about like what we're doing right now. If we're successful, could have a huge impact on the lives of those animals that right now sort of die and, almost with a curtain of silence around them. People just don't even think about it almost.
And you just said then if we're successful, so is there a chance you might not be successful?
There's always that risk in the business world and in the startup world. Startups can fail for a thousand reasons. There's, technology risk. Those are often what people focus on. But really, it's a hard thing to scale up. It is a brutal game, where nickels and dimes really matter because if you're losing a quarter on every product and you're making millions and millions of units of that product, then you're in big trouble. And so, you were talking about at the beginning, I think we're moving into the phase of execution risk rather than technical risk, where there's a magical dance we have to perform of finding customers, finding the right size production facilities where we don't have to invest a lot into them, getting that to work, and then repeating that in multiple versions as the business grows. And so any industry faces this. I was talking to a CEO of a really famous alternative dairy brand earlier this week, who went through these same growing pains. And even though there was a massive quantity of demand, they had a hard time meeting it because of challenges with their supply chain. So I think it's just, they were largely impacted by COVID, which nobody would have predicted at the time. So you never know what's sort of going to come out of the woodwork and bite you as you try to scale up. And so there's always the chance that we fail. But the reason we do this is because if we're successful, it has this fantastic impact on the world. And so it's worth fighting that battle to try to get this product out there.
Was that perfect day you were just there?
No, this was a plant-based milk
All right.
that
Okay.
animal.
So, on the so if you were to put if you were to sort of put odds on success, would you say that your odds are more in favor of being successful, that you're going to get the scaling right, and that it's going to work? How optimistic are you?
These questions are always painful to answer.
Well,
I
I
will
suppose
preface
it's
this as
very, you know, you are in it every day, so you feel the anxiety, but you also feel the excitement, right?
and it alternates between those two polar extremes all the time. I mean, I'm an engineer, so I tend to look at things very pessimistically. And address the technology that way. But I feel like we are in the 50 to 75% chance of being successful quartile, I would say. And for me at a startup at this earliest stage, that's an exciting place to be. Because I've definitely been in startups where there's even crazier ideas and you're even, further away from success, but you're still plugging away at it. So I think what we've accomplished in the last 18 months in terms of retuning the process and the scalability of it, what we're seeing from the customer interest out there that we're working with right now, and our ability to sort of navigate some of these funding challenges makes me very, very hope, very excited and confident of that 50 to 75% chance.
50 to 75% chance. Okay. So one last question before you go, just out, because I know that in America the kind of government has been a little bit slow in kind of investing in these sort of new novel kind of cultivated products. Have you had any support at all?
No. And we've sort of been looking. There are some smaller grants out there. There's a tissue engineering facility that just got designated a US like biofoundry. They have some money to start to dole out over the coming years. What we're finding though is a lot of those are really structured toward smaller scale, or I would say like earlier stage stuff, more like seed stage. What we did take advantage of, we're not using it right now, but we used a program from the US government, USDA. They have a loan guarantee program where the whole idea is to help these first of a kind manufacturing facilities get off the ground because banks traditionally don't want to invest in them. They're a very risky proposition because it's a first of a kind factory. But companies often don't want to use venture dollars to fund it because that's a very expensive way to try to fund building a factory. And so what the USDA has is this loan guarantee program where you submit an application and you go through a series of phases. And when you if you get approved behind with that, you they basically back your loan. So you can go out and you can borrow $100 million from a bank, and the government is there to say, if this company fails, then we will cover the loan to the bank. And so it helps de-risk some of that. We went through this program last year. We made it through phase one. And so we will use that hopefully in the future for our factory as part of getting the financing for the factory. So that's very helpful for us because it de-risks for the bank that investment. And it means we don't have to use venture capital dollars to build that factory.
Okay, and there's the private sort of philanthropy as well, as the kind of Bezos Foundation, which is the Horizon Project in Europe, but I suspect that there's money in the US as well, isn't there, from these foundations?
That is a definitely another route that we were looking into
Nice.
as well. Everybody's getting creative with financing these days.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you very much for talking to me. It's been interesting, and this is one of the products I was most excited to see when I first kind of got into this area. So I am fingers crossed that we will be able to buy this stuff in the near future.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate being here. And yeah, stay tuned. Hopefully in the next 12 to 24 months, you can buy that product from us.